You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you all to this coming debate on Europe and South Caucasus, the best approach. My name is Jacqueline Hale, and I'm an analyst with the Open Society Institute Brussels, working on EU external relations policy and the particular units for the South Caucasus and Central Asia. Now, it's testament to this, the importance of this region that we are having more and more debates like this in Brussels. It's also a testament to the challenges, the myriad of challenges that are faced by the three countries comprising the South Caucasus. Now, on my panel today, we have an excellent range of people and perspectives on the region. Thank you for allowing me to be to work. Their important work in and on the region. Now, I'd like to introduce them in reverse order of speaking, beginning with Ron Asmus, who is a, as you well know, a distinguished commentator and a pillar of US foreign policy. And as we're all very happy to have him back with us in Brussels after a short period of absence. Ron is well known in particular for his work within the US State Department as Deputy Assistant Secretary for European Affairs under the second Clinton administration. He now, as we know, heads up GMF's very successful work in Brussels and is the author of a number of books and commentaries, in particular a little book about a little war that shook the world. Is a distinguished commentator on a range of affairs that has written widely on particularly Russia's relationship with its near abroad and in the European Union. Next up, we have Peter Semlevy, who is himself a distinguished player with a record of service in both the Swedish Foreign Ministry and within the OSCE, heading up missions in Croatia and in Latvia, before taking up his current role as EU Special Representative for the South Caucasus, where he is well known for his indefatigable work bringing the parties together, both in the South Caucasus, and it might be said, controversially, also in Brussels, the member states. And finally, coming to Tom Duval, who is a senior associate of the Carnegie Endowment for Peace in Washington and is well known as a watcher of the Caucasus over a number of years and the author of the book Black Garden, which is really considered a definitive work on Nagorno-Karabakh. Tom is now approaching the release of his new work, which is entitled The Caucasus, an introduction. We have with us, unfortunately, very few copies. We have more flyers. Apparently the copies have difficulty arriving in Brussels, but I do hear that they've already got to Tbilisi, so they're read by the right people. If you're interested in getting a copy, please speak to Tom after this event. Now, I'm going to give each of the speakers 10 minutes to broach the subject of the Caucasus, and in particular the way the European Union should engage with this region. And so I'd like to, without further ado, have the floor to Tom to give his view on the subject. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Jackie. It's very good to be here. I thought that a breakfast event was a kind of Washington phenomenon. Good to see that it's caught on in Brussels as well. Good to see so many of you turn out this morning. This is a sort of, I think we originally designed it as a kind of book event, but it's become a book event without a book. But that actually means that we can talk more about ideas, which is obviously a good thing, because I think the South Caucasus is in the need of some good ideas. But it gives me a chance, having spent a year writing a kind of overview of the South Caucasus, to make a few generalizations and in a rather like a Soviet commissar to come up with a few slogans for the future and some ideas. I suppose I start with the idea that the Caucasus is the South Caucasus. I'm not going to talk only tangentially about the North Caucasus. The South Caucasus is really the kind of lands in between, that can be positive and negative. The lands in between Europe and Asia, Christianity and Islam, democracy and authoritarianism. And that means that they can both be a crossroads and a communications hub in a positive sense, and also, as the Economist review of my book called it, a playground for war, and a place that falls between, in a negative sense, falls between the cracks. It's obviously a challenge to engage in a region like this, because it's not a conventional region, although I do believe it is a region, and we can talk about a bit about that if you want to. This leads me to reject some of the metaphors that have been applied to this region, which I unfortunately have spread through many book titles, but like a kind of virus. One I reject is the idea that this is a great chessboard in which the great powers push the locals around like pawns. Another I have a strong aversion to is the idea of a new great game, replicating the struggle between Britain and Russia in the 19th century. I think these are rather patronising metaphors for the locals. They treat them as sort of objects to be pushed around by bigger powers. They do not give agency to the locals and encourage them to sort of ask bigger outsiders to solve their problems. And I don't think it's actually accurate, because I think those of us who know the Caucasus know that for 200 years the locals have actually spent the last 200 years cultivating the skill of playing off the big powers, assuring them that they're important and actually getting on with their own business. That applies to the 19th century, when the locals actually did quite well in many respects after the Russian Empire. It applies to the Soviet period, where the locals actually pretty much ran the show, with obviously due nods to Moscow. But I think it's no accident, for example, that Haydar Aliyev and Edward Shevardnadze, where one moment they were loyal servants of Moscow, the next moment they made a transition to be presidents of independent Azerbaijan and Georgia. No one was really surprised, because basically they'd actually been running those places for 30 years. So I don't think these are useful or accurate metaphors, but they are unfortunately quite prevalent. And I also think they overemphasize the place of Russia. Russia is obviously the most, the strongest neighbour and power in this region, but I also believe that Russia is not all powerful here, that it has to reckon with the interests of others. And that Russia's, increasingly, Russia's levers are diminished in this region, that there are actually now less than 2% of the population is ethnic Russian compared to the situation in Ukraine or Kazakhstan or even the Baltic states. The Russian, with the large and obvious exception of Abkhazia and South Ossetia, the Russian military presence is actually quite small, and it's not clear to me how it can use that military presence, even in Armenia, for political goals. I think the Armenian government listens to the Russians, but when it doesn't agree, it actually absolutely does what it wants to. And I think the Russians have enough problems now consolidating their own statehood, and particularly consolidating the North Caucasus, to want to exert some kind of hegemonic role over the South Caucasus. Again, I do think Abkhazia and South Ossetia are the exceptions, but even on South Ossetia I do see a long-term trend in which Russia has taken on burden it probably doesn't really want in South Ossetia, and will probably be more flexible in the next years. Abkhazia is probably the most difficult place, but maybe we should turn to that in questions rather than now. And if you look at Armenia and Azerbaijan, we see Russia and the United States and France actually cooperating extremely well. The Minsk group, you talk to the diplomats of all three countries, and they say, I think quite sincerely, that they see no daylight between them on the Karabakh conflict. And if it was up to them, that conflict would be resolved. It's very much about local resistance to solutions rather than international imposition of solutions. What does this lead me to conclude? Well, and this I think is obviously my clear difference with my neighbour Ron, is that I don't believe it's useful for parts of this region to belong to military blocs. That one, therefore, was a strong opponent of the idea of Georgian NATO accession. Clearly, I'm not denying the theoretical right of Georgia to join NATO, and clearly Georgians voted in the referendum to join NATO, but I don't think at that point and the foreseeable future it's useful for either Georgia or NATO. I think it actually makes Georgia's security problems worse and really doesn't address the much more critical issue for Georgia, which is Abkhazia and South Ossetia, two places that look towards Russia for protection, and how do you square that with NATO membership of Georgia. So I think I see in a rather utopian manner that the South Caucasus would be best off as a kind of zone of neutrality. Clearly this is quite a long way from being a zone of neutrality, but something that we should aspire to, in which the great powers have a sort of truce and everyone agrees that anyone else's interest in the South Caucasus is acceptable so long as it is not military or hostile. And this leads me to a only half seriously, but there is a dose of seriousness in what I'm saying, is that a dose of strategic insignificance would be rather good for this region, in which people stopped looking at it as a kind of zone in which great power politics have played out, in which people pay far more attention to local dynamics and bottom-up institution building. This also gets me back to the idea that what we need is a regional approach. This is a small region of three countries plus three unrecognised or partially recognised entities, and it can only really thrive if those parts are connected economically in terms of transport and communications. And one of my slogans that I've been parading around Washington is death to bilateralism. I think we have to stop regarding policy for the Caucasus as three sets of policies to Baku, Yerevan, and Tbilisi, often with very different agendas, particularly in Washington, but also in other places, and look for a more holistic regional approach which encourages these people to work together rather than putting them in separate boxes. I realise I haven't got much time. A couple of comments about the EU. Well, I suppose my most optimistic thought about the EU is that it could be the tortoise and not the hare in this region, as in the Aesop's fable, that the US and Russia have been the hare and have dashed in, and in many cases made a bit of a mess of their engagement with this region. The fact that the EU has rather under-engaged, despite the honourable efforts of a few individuals like Peter, could obviously, I think, has been unfortunate, but could be its asset in the sense that the EU has not stored up baggage for itself in the way that other powers have. And I think the EU is, of course, the best agent, as we all know, and look at the Balkans, to engage in kind of bottom-up institution building, economic integration, sort of things the Caucasus needs. And my final slogan for the morning is rebuild the railways. I've been accused of being a sort of little boy who wants who likes train sets, but I do think this actually is a serious idea. But if you look at the map of the Caucasus, the railways are broken through Abkhazia, through the occupied territories in the Karabakh conflict. Azerbaijan is separated from its own exclave of Nakhichevan. And if you were to find some project, which the EU surely would be the main agent in, for reconstructing the railways with some kind of status-neutral solution to the problems of travel documents and crossing borders, you would find the Armenians would be reconnected to Russia via Abkhazia. You would find Azerbaijan would be reconnected to itself you find Georgia being suddenly linked again to Iran. I think this would all be a very positive confidence-building measure, which would kind of facilitate the economic restoration of this region, and also a first step towards solving its conflict. So this is my final thought: rebuild the road.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Tom, for that
nuanced
account. I think we'll come to Ron later on questions of strategic insignificance of the role of NATO in the region. But I'd like to turn now to Peter. You've heard a ringing endorsement of EU efforts, or a potential EU efforts, I should rather say, and the EU role as a tortoise. I'm not quite sure how that works in my mind as imagery, but perhaps you'll have a better idea, Peter. I'll give you the floor for 10 minutes.
Thank you, Jackie. And Daphne, first of all, recommend this book to anybody who is interested in the Caucasus. I think it's a great read, both for those who maybe need an introduction, who do not have the background before, but it's also very worthwhile because of its very vivid accounts of many things for and many details also for the experts. Now, the South Caucasus is still an unstable and unpredictable region, and the conflicts are, of course, the most important part of this. They are separatist conflicts, they are bilateral conflicts between the countries in the region and their neighbors, and they are conflicts that are being played out at several different levels at the same time. We have an intercommunity level, we have an interstate level that to a large extent has hijacked the intercommunity conflicts, was the case in Georgia in 2008, and we have a larger strategic level as well. These conflicts, I would argue, should be of serious concern to us. South Caucasus is Europe's immediate neighborhood, anything that happens in the South Caucasus will also have an impact on the European Union. And we saw this in 2008, August 2008. We also saw that complacency is dangerous. The conflicts in the Caucasus are not frozen, I would say. If you grade them somewhere on a temperature scale, it's not on the freezing point, but they are somewhere immediately under the boiling point. So frozen does not mean, well, I would argue that they're not frozen, but even so, frozen does not mean safe. Also, the close borders between Armenia, Azerbaijan, Armenia, Turkey, and the absence of a full functional relationship between Georgia and Russia also hamper the full potential of the region. Now, what can the EU do? I think the EU can have impact in many different ways. First of all, I would mention the freedom of movement. This is something that is of huge interest to people in the region, to the countries in the region, and is also a very most effective way of bringing these places closer to the EU and having an impact on things. I'm talking about free movement, both of people and of goods and services. The second kind of impact, category is for the EU as a provider of security, and this can be done in many different ways. We are now doing it on the ground in Georgia after the war through the EU monitoring mission, through the incident prevention and response mechanisms that are a result of the Geneva talks and so on. There's really more that we can do here as well. We can also provide the security indirectly through a closer institutional relationship that gives reassurances to the countries in the region, and it also gives us a better understanding of their predicament and their situation. And then we can make more targeted efforts towards conflict transformation and conflict resolution. And here also there's a lot more that we can do. Then I think the EU can also be useful in promoting, being a framework itself to provide regional coherence. This is what Tom just talked about. The EU can help, for example, in a rather abstract way, in building a new common identity, sort of adding on a European layer of identity to the national identities and replacing a bit of the formerly failed Soviet identity. We can provide regional coherence, or promote regional coherence, by making the countries in the region move in the same direction, by aligning their reform agendas, by aligning their strategic objectives. And we can facilitate the contacts of these countries with their regional neighbors, with whom they often have complicated relationships, both people-to-people contacts and more institutional ones. We can also provide this regional coherence in a very hands-on way, and I very much subscribe to Tom's final point here about the railways, or more the railways as a metaphor for communications in general. I think we need to promote efforts, or make efforts and promote measures that will allow people on different sides of the borders and administrative boundaries in the region to develop joint interests, and that will ultimately, I believe, be the engine also to address some of the more intractable political issues related to the conflicts. If you also look at the conflict areas in the region, the three conflicts, Abkhazia, South Ossetia, and Nagorno-Karabakh, one thing they do have in common is that they have all straddled important strategic communications routes. Nagorno-Karabakh is the conflict that I would actually highlight most. For many reasons, I believe it represents the greatest risk at the moment. I'm happy to go into the details why I believe so, but basically it's an unregulated ceasefire. It's a conflict that may have seemed stable for a decade and a half, but which does not exist in a vacuum. There are things happening around it all the time. Some things benefiting Armenia, other things benefiting Azerbaijan, and always when something happens with temptation for the other party to compensate. There's an arms race going on, all of which is lowering the threshold for an escalation of some kind. I don't think that the conflict would get out of hand because of a deliberate move on any of the parties, at least not at this stage, but it is becoming more unstable. And here the EU can also, or should, do a lot more than we have done so far. Prepare societies and public opinion, engage with the parties, including Karabakh. We've had to find a way of engaging with people in Karabakh itself. We cannot allow white spots on the map in our neighborhood. We can deal with practical issues on the ground. We can support a stronger ceasefire. We can prepare our contributions following a settlement, like reconstruction, securing the settlement, and so on. On the Georgian conflict regions, we are, I think one of the most important things to do now is to develop also here, in addition to the Geneva talks that are going on relating that after the ceasefire related to a fairly narrow set of security related issues and issues related to refugees, IDPs. We should also develop an engagement policy going beyond the Geneva talks for Abkhazia and South Ossetia, in order to use the EU soft power in these entities to increase our leverage and opportunities to move the conflict resolution process forward. And I'm talking here about education, health, cross-boundary business, communications, cooperation on drug abuse, trafficking, law enforcement, human rights related issues, and so on. We need to do this in close contact with the Georgian authorities in order to, both because the government in Tbilisi is the government that we recognize, we have to work within a framework that is acceptable to Georgia. But we also should help Georgia overcome an ambivalence that still exists towards this kind of engagement. There is a kind of tug of war going on, debate in Georgia between those who see engagement as a way of creating joint interests, links, leverages, on the one hand, and on the other hand, those that would argue that any engagement runs the risk of legitimizing the status quo, the Russian military presence, the de facto regimes, and so on. And here, any external partner, strong external partner like the European Union, has a profound can mitigate these fears of legitimization by maintaining a firm line, a very firm policy in terms of the non-recognition. Actually, we're talking about a policy resting on two legs here, non-recognition and engagement, where one leg is not thinkable without the other. Non-recognition without engagement is sterile, it would push these places further away from Georgia, but engagement without non-recognition is also dangerous, slippery slope. So in conclusion, I would then just say that restate the obvious, that this is a region of multiple conflicts and at many different levels. We have Karabakh, Turkey, Armenia, Georgia, Russia, we have Abkhazia, we have South Ossetia. It's also a region that is influenced by other neighbors that are not easy, take Iran, for example. All these complex and intertwined relationships and conflicts do require, and I very much support Tom's argument here, a regional, comprehensive, and multifaceted approach. For the EU, this is crucially important, because I believe very much that the credibility of the European Union as an actor on the world stage starts in its own, the building of that credibility starts in its own neighborhood. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Peter, for also highlighting the differences between the stakes to a certain extent of these conflicts, pointing to the rather negative dynamic trajectory that is emerging around Nagorno-Karabakh, and perhaps we could return to that in the question and answer session. I'd like to give the floor now, last but not least, to Ron. I'd like Ron to perhaps take issue with some of these points made by the previous speakers. So Ron, I'd give the floor without any further ado.
Thank you. Well, let me first start by congratulating Tom on his book. And I, even though he and I disagree on some issues, he is one of the foremost experts on the Caucasus. And I think all of us know there's really a paucity of literature in English on the region, and his books are all central reading, in my view. And I've had the chance to read this one, and it's every time I read him, I learn a lot. And the lack of knowledge is also, I have to say, if I look back at the debates of the last 10 years, I shuddered how many meetings senior American European officials were in who didn't know very much about the region and were making big decisions. So, get them all to read your book, even if we subsequently have a policy debate. I basically think in terms of US and EU policy, there's two huge issues up there that we sort of duck. The first issue is, and let's be blunt about it, how far do we think the Europe we want to integrate extends? And if we're honest, we go back to the early debates in the early 90s, when we talked about unified Europe, when we wrote the Charter of Paris, when we wrote all those signature documents, and when the debate about NATO and EU emergence started, we weren't thinking about Georgia. We were thinking about Visegrad, we were thinking about maybe the Baltics, though that was a huge radical idea. And the very first proposal for NATO enlargement was for three countries, four countries, Visegrad, that was it. And people weren't thinking about the Southern Balkans, they weren't thinking about Ukraine. And the narrative that emerged about Europe only free, about these countries coming back, didn't include these regions. And if anyone tells me they were thinking about it in 1993, 95, 97, I'd say, come on, you're just making this stuff up. And I remember once when I was in the State Department in charge of it, somebody came up to me and said, what about Georgia? And I laughed. I said, you gotta be kidding, it would be a miracle if we get Poland in, if we get the Baltics in. Georgia, I've never been there in my life. It wasn't on our radar screen as a country we wanted to integrate and attach to the West. It was a country whose independence we cared about, but it was way low on the priority list. And that was essentially true for the 90s. And then after the Rose and Orange Revolution, a reset set in, but it's never been consummated. Because some percentage of us said, there's another wider Europe we need to open up to, and others didn't. And in a nutshell, today, that's the debate we have within the US government, within the American policy community, and within the EU. Those countries that think once the Balkans are integrated, that's it, that's the Europe we're talking about, and we don't want to go any further, those people want to keep the door open, and with varying degrees of enthusiasm, try to anchor Ukraine, the Caucasus, Southern Caucasus, et cetera, et cetera. That debate has never been resolved. And we frankly don't even talk about it very openly, except maybe over a whiskey late at night among ourselves. But until that debate is resolved, and until we have a narrative, because in a sense, the scheme, you can either say the old concept was successfully implemented, thank you very much, congratulate ourselves, have a glass of champagne and go home, or you can say the old narrative is run out of steam, which I think is out of intellectual and political steam. And the reality is, the world has changed since then. These countries are different, more different as the West, and Russia's different. So if we were to have a strategy, if we were to have a new narrative that we all could subscribe to and support, it can't just be a repeat of what we said in 1995, or 97, or 98, or even 2000. The other problem we have is that this region, as Tom spoke points out, is a lot more complicated and harder. And we were joking about how Fabrice has gone into government, and I'm curious what his experience will be. One of my first experiences in government was to discover how when there's a hard problem, you redefine the problem as opposed to try to tackle it. I used to always joke that every bureaucrat has a drawer called too hard to handle, because he can never go to his secretary of state or his boss and say, there is no answer to this. That's sort of bureaucratic and unacceptable. So the tricks you use is you redefine the problem. And I remember during the Bosnian War, a very senior US government official said to me, well, we're not going to do all these things. What we're going to do is declare this an unsolvable conflict that goes back 1,000 years in which no one can be responsible for except the local natives themselves, and that will get us off the hook. And that is a classic bureaucratic way of saying it's not our fault, it's their fault. And there, let's be honest, there's elements of this when it comes to this region where you don't want to take the responsibility of trying to solve a problem. You never want to send your boss out there to fail. So you redefine the problem in ways that they don't, or you throw a special envoy at the problem. Now, sometimes special envoys are really intended to solve problems, and they're backed up by political will, and they're given, you know, a mandate, and sometimes they're a band-aid to show you're doing something when you don't know what the hell to do. Now, I hope, Peter, and I think the reality is for a number of EU countries, you're a real envoy who's supposed to solve it, and to be quite honest, there may be a few who are a little bit less enthusiastic and don't mind if you make 100 more trips and nothing really happens as long as the place doesn't explode. And you know, until we resolve this ambivalence among ourselves, we're not going to have a coherent policy. And then the big question is, what, even if we could resolve all that, what would that coherent policy be? Now, I agree, we need to think regionally. The whole Ukrainian-Georgian tandem, if it made sense at one point, it often doesn't make sense anymore. It probably didn't make sense in the first place, for all the reasons you can figure out. Pros and conflicts. Well, let me step back. I think the first question we have to decide is really principles. Because there is a fight underway at the moment as to whether those principles of the Charter of Paris still apply. And clearly the Russians wish they didn't apply anymore. They want to rewrite them. It's part of the Russian initiative. And there are some countries that are open to, you know, reopening the language. And there are other countries, probably the United States and some others, will draw the line and say, no, this is a slippery slope, those are cardinal principles. we're not going to touch them. And that's one of the diplomatic fights that's going to take place at the OSCE. It takes place in NATO Russia. It takes place in almost every negotiation with the Russians today. So do we still believe the principle of the Charter of Paris apply 20 years later in regions like the Southern Caucasus? You couldn't get 27 EU heads of state to raise their hand and say that. I don't think so. And you would even find people in the United States that would say, oh, come on, it's just later. You can move beyond that. That was true then. It's different now. 20 years later, let's rethink some of this. So you have a principle, then you have, we don't have a regional strategy. We don't, as Americans, you have elements of a framework, but is it a real regional strategy? Not yet. And then there's the question of, you know, you come back to envoys engagement. You know, I always tell Americans, we spent $1 billion after the war in reconstruction aid to the Georgians. We were begging for tens of millions of dollars to fund programs for the previous 5 years. $100 million in the right programs, in the right places, with the right gestures, and strength and right mechanisms, and that war never would have happened, frankly. So, you know, this complacency, this penny-wise, pound-foolish, it's too tricky, you'll get sucked in, hang back, all that stuff doesn't work, you know, from a policy perspective, and it leads us to pay, in my view, a much higher cost down the road. Now, I look at the region today, and Tom and I disagree. I think the principles are still valid and have to be valid, so these countries do have the right to choose their own foreign policy course. Second, some of them, starting with Georgia, but not starting over with Georgia, feel existentially threatened. And, you know, it's not up to us to tell them to be neutral or not to be neutral. These are decisions they have to make for themselves. And we have to respect that wish while not necessarily automatically embracing or agreeing with it, because we have to make up our own minds too, which is why we have a debate. But I look at the region on the ground. I was one of those people who felt they saw the war coming. And for years I've been begging people to make an investment, be it in the UN, be it in the OSCE process, get another 100 monitors, do all these things, and everybody said, you're exaggerating, it's too hard, we'll never get the Russians to agree. I look at the mechanisms on the ground today, and again, there's sort of a lull, there's stability, but could those mechanisms really hold if we had a real crisis in the region? I don't think they would. So, you know, this is a fair weather policy, both for the United States and for the EU. It's not a policy that has enough stuff on the ground and mechanisms in place that if we have a real crisis, it would necessarily hold. And that real crisis, my biggest fear, is the unraveling of the Northern Caucasus, the spillover into the Southern Caucasus, and U.S.-Russian and EU-Russian relations as a whole, which I feel is another movie that's slowly playing itself out. And I hope it doesn't happen, and I hope the Russians are smart enough to contain it, and we're smart enough to figure out how to, you know, prevent things from getting worse. But, you know, in that sense, I'm pessimistic that we still haven't learned the lessons in 2008 and drawn the right conclusions and come up with a much more robust policy, irrespective of whether you believe in NATO membership or not. You can set that issue aside, frankly, for a while and focus on all these other issues just to make sure the region, you know, doesn't spin off the rails. I'll stop right there.
Thank you very much, Ron, for tackling the issue of strategy and the absence thereof. I'd like to take questions at this point. Do you have any? Would like to have, yes, one at the back, gentleman at the back, and then one here. If you could stand up and give your name and function before you ask the question. Thank you.
Good morning. Christophe Kledix, I'm a journalist for a Belgian monthly magazine. I was in the Nagorno-Karabakh 1 month ago. I have one question about it from Peter, one from Tom. Tom, I spoke to a guy that you probably know, Alexander Iskandarian. He's the director of the Caucasus Institute. He said the best case scenario at this moment for the next 10 to 15 years would be the status quo, a situation like Cyprus, Kashmir, or Taiwan, because if there would be fighting every 5 years, that wouldn't solve anything. So status quo, not so bad at all for Nagorno-Karabakh. Then Peter, as a journalist, it was very hard for me. When I went to Nagorno-Karabakh, I couldn't go to Agdam and several other places, and Azerbaijan hasn't even issued me a visa after waiting 6 weeks. My question is, can the EU improve somehow the press freedom in the region? Thank you.
Great, great last question from perspective here from the Stein Institute. I'd like to take a second question and then we'll come back to the panel.
My name is Marin Kuraus, and I'm Arthur. And I'm political advisor of Croatian NATO mission. I'm doing NGC, among the other things, and I hope that the Cheltenham House rules apply here.
Not sure that they do. Because I think we have some TV cameras there.
Well, I should throw the mic then. So my question is to Mr. Deval, rather two questions actually. You started your talk with polemizing directly with another book of another Swede, Mr. Garvin. The subtitle is Georgia, Pawn in the Great Game. So as a Croatian, I can easily understand your point of and subscribe to your point of being strategically irrelevant as being a blessing for South Caucasus. But I can't see how you can undo the all the oil and gas in Caspian, BTC pipeline, and even if you build your railways, which would be definitely a good thing, or rebuild them, how would that increase the irrelevance? Wouldn't that increase the relevance on the region? That's the first question. And the second one is, although you polemized with the book, you seem to me that you actually agree with the point made by the Swedish author that Georgia should go for some kind of Finlandization in bad old Cold War times. So pretty much give up on hopes on reintegrating Abkhazia and South Ossetia. The other solution he was mentioning is Cyprus solution, as the colleague there was mentioning, and also he argues for the neutrality of Georgia and all the three countries of South Caucasus, since we are not under Cheltenham House rules, and I'm a NATO man, and obviously I support Georgia's NATO's mission and Bucharest decisions. Thank you.
Okay. I'm sure that all three of us would have comments on this. On Nagorno-Karabakh, well, even, of course, Alec Iskandarian is one of the most enlightened Armenians, but it's very easy, if you're an Armenian, to say the status quo is fine, because obviously the status quo currently is in the Armenians' favour, and it's not fine if you're an Azerbaijani IDP who was displaced from territories currently under the control of Armenians. So we have to be, and clearly I think the Azerbaijanis are being very counterproductive in that policy. They're making things worse for themselves by this aggressive rhetoric which encourages the Armenians to dig in and do nothing. But I think basically for me in Karabakh the issue at the moment is neither side wants to do anything constructive. And then the quest, even small steps, they reject even small constructive steps. So I think the question to the international community is, can we put up with that? Shouldn't we make the price higher of doing nothing constructive? And we should, set out a menu of constructive measures which will stabilise the situation, which will improve the lives of some people. I'm not talking about all people. And encourage both sides to do for it, to implement some of them or to agree on some of them, which means we have a sort of status quo plus. I don't believe we can solve the problem at the moment, but we can at least ameliorate it. On your issues, I'm not talking about irrelevance in general. I'm talking about I would like the South Caucasus to be an economically relevant region, a transport hub where between Europe and Asia, with lots of nice trade and business flowing through it, lots of nice fiber optic cables and high speed railways and all sorts of things. That's the kind of relevance I want for the Caucasus. And I suppose this is again gets back to the sort of issue I have with Ron. I think we probably want the same things for the Caucasus, but we see different sequencing. I see the importance on kind of institution building, state building. I don't think we have proper states there. I think you have to, that the states really have to become more durable, and that means a lot of work they have to do themselves before we can start talking about things like NATO accession. And I see the EU instruments as being the ones which can be used here, even if they're not necessarily being used at the moment.
Peter, would you like to come in? The question on visa for journalists, I think Peter, would you like to take it? Also, we have a BTC pipeline.
Let me just say on BTC pipeline, I think Russia now accepts that the BTC pipeline is there. There's even talk about Russia trying to buy a stake in it, which I think would be a positive thing, that they were on the inside rather than the outside. I don't think Nabucco is going to be the next BTC. I just don't see that there's enough gas. So I think that the pipeline policy is what we have on the map. I don't see that as being a strategic factor anymore, only in the negative sense that the Karabakh conflict, the new Karabakh conflict, could disrupt those pipelines.
On the status quo in Nagorno-Karabakh, well, I think Tom put it quite well, the status quo plus maybe best available possibility at this moment. Certainly the current status quo with the self-regulating ceasefire with Nagorno-Karabakh remaining a wide spot in terms of international engagements is not sustainable. As far as your problems with visas are concerned, I can only sympathize with you and tell you that the engagement of international actors like the EU and others is also extremely difficult. Unfortunately, in the attempts that we have made from the side of the EU to engage, to travel, to have a look at the situation, to see what we can do on the ground, have been turned out on all occasions to have been impossible because the parties to the conflict ultimately have not been able to resist the temptation to instrumentalize our offers of engagement, of assessment missions, and so on, in order to further their tactical objectives in this conflict. But we have to continue to work on this, because if we don't do anything, this conflict will explode at some point. The railways, whether they increase or decrease the strategic significance of the region or not, well, I'm not sure the formulation of the question is helpful. The railways have another purpose, to develop, or the development of communications has another purpose, to develop joint interests across the boundaries and borders that are closed or very difficult to cross today. And it's quite easy, in a way also, that it's not mutually exclusive, not in a zero-sum game, because if you open up communications in both east-west direction and north-south direction, you will have everybody's interests involved. The European Union, Turkey, Russia, all the countries in the region, the people also living in the in the conflict regions. Finlandization, I'm not sure it's useful as an example or a metaphor for this article. So Finlandization was something that happened in a very specific period during the Cold War, and lots of specific conditions also why it worked during that period. So I would warn against using that term. As far as the Bucharest decisions are concerned, while I'm not a NATO person, so I can say that I think there are inconsistencies, obviously, in the Bucharest decisions that made some things problematic. on the one hand, they state that in a rather deterministic way that Ukraine and Georgia will become members, but then in the same breath, almost, that they're not so sure after all. And, I think that caused a lot of, made some things worse.
Thank you. So, Ron, if you'd like to come back quickly, and we have hands here.
Well, you know, I would say the question, do you believe in the Charter of Paris or not? That's exactly what I was talking about, because what you talked about is not the Charter of Paris. We say keep the geopolitics out of the region, but then we want to impose Finlandization or neutrality on them. In 1990, people called for the Finlandization of Poland. For 5 years, people called for the Finlandization of Baltic states. Thank God we didn't listen to them. So why, as soon as Croatia is on its own track...
But
it's very easy once you're in to call for Finlandization of the countries that are next to you further out. And it's a question of, do we believe in these principles anymore? And I'm saying people are doubting them. So let's have that debate in public as opposed to in private. Because I don't believe if Moldova wants neutrality, is anyone complaining about Moldova wanting neutrality? No, because it's their decision. Ukraine has switched course. Are people freaking out over Ukraine switching course on the NATO issue? No. Countries should have the right. We decided in 1990 not to build that world of forced neutrality and Finlandization. And I'm really saying I spent my entire career not going in that direction. And if we're going in that direction, maybe I'll lose the debate, maybe we will. But let's be conscious and have the first principle debate and then think about the strategies that flow from. I do not believe I'm as interested in better Georgian-Russian relations as anyone else. But if we do Finlandization neutrality, that's not the way to get to better Georgian-Russian relations. Poland is finally starting to have a reconciliation with Russia only because it's in NATO and the EU, only because it feels secure enough to have that dialogue with Russia. You can't build stability and security based on insecurity and existential threats. So whether that means NATO or whether that means something else, we have to take the fear out of this equation so that countries can actually reconcile. And I don't think that's the way to do it.
Okay, and we've got about 10 minutes left to debate. I have three hands here. Tom might want to come back on here on the neutrality issue. That's up to you, Tom. I'd like to take the question first from Amanda, then we have a question here in the front row, and then from Alain.
Hi, Amanda Cole from the European Policy Centre. I'd just like to hear the panel's comments on the role of Turkey in the region. Turkey, with its new dynamic foreign policy, seemed to start off with very good intentions, but somewhere along the line, things started to go wrong with the failure or the freezing now of the rapprochement with Armenia and the knock-on effect the whole rapprochement had on the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict. What sort of role do you think Turkey could now actually play in that region? Is it possible to reinvigorate the rapprochement with Armenia? And could Turkey really be a player in the resolution of Karabakh conflict, something that they still really believe they could do?
Thank you. Feliza Kese from the European Azerbaijan Society. Thank you all for your thought-provoking intervention. I also agree that the EU needs to have a large role in the region. I also agree with you, Ms. Lee, that the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict is certainly needs greater attention, because it's a fact that over the last 17 years, not much has been done with the OSCE Minsk group, unfortunately. The EU seems to have ideas, yes. Thank you for your efforts in the region. However, it seems to lack coherence, is a tortoise, and is contradicting itself. So do you believe that now with the creation of the new the European External Action Service, there will be more of a real strategy for South Caucasus and more coherence? Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yes, Brussels, when you start. Melanie Littor from the International Crisis Group. Well, my view on the South Caucasus is that I think for as long as Russian society doesn't change very deeply and power in Moscow doesn't change, the situation in Georgia, which is the Abkhazia, South Ossetia, is frozen for very long perspective. I don't think that the Russians
for as long as they remain under this government, they will accept any kind of neutrality in the South Caucasus more than Germany would accept Belgian neutrality in the 20th century, for instance. But the big question now is Karabakh, and several of you have raised this issue. It is alarming. The amount of incidents, the amount of money invested in weapons in both sides of the Bosnia and Azerbaijan. And I very much like the journalist's question, because if there is one conflict in the world where there is a direct link between the explosivity of the conflict and the freedom of press, I think it's the Nagorno-Karabakh. The two public opinions in Azerbaijan and Armenia are constantly under the same narrative. So they are totally unprepared for any compromise. And we see the group means failing all the time. But the question I would have is how the US and the European Union could, in a way, I would even use the word impose a new public debate on what it is to make a compromise. Second question, more concrete maybe, is that right now Baku accepts the Madrid principles and Armenia refuses them. Of course, usually in that region, when one side accepts a compromise, the other one doesn't, and vice versa. A few months ago, it was Baku that was not accepted. But okay, right now, Baku accepts the Madrid principles. Armenia cannot move. Is there a way to put pressure and to help change the narrative within Armenia? I mean, in Armenia now, you have historians, politicians, saying that the seven districts occupied around Nagorno-Karabakh is historical Armenian land, which is a big change of what you could hear still two to four years ago. So on that one, I'd like to hear you. What do you see possible? We're speaking about two countries which are those have very strong links to Western countries, and where obviously our impact as a Western democracy is close to nil.
Thank you for those three very good questions. I see a hand, and because we're running short of time, I'm going to take it from Magdalena, and then I'm going to ask the panel, starting with Tom, to Peter to respond to your questions.
Thank you. Just a very quick question. I think Magdalena Pritchard brought up conservation resources. I wanted to ask a very quick question. I think all of the three speakers have used the word complacency, decried it, that it has been basically one of the problems in the region, especially prior to 2008, both in with respect to the conflict resolution policies, but also perhaps with respect to democratization policies in the three countries. And I wanted to ask you, what is the sense of the issue of complacency 2 years after the 2008 war, and how what lessons have the international community really learned in that respect?
Okay, so we have Turkey, incoherence of the EU response, the new EAS, what does it mean, the question of neutrality, and the Nagorno-Karabakh, and Madrid principles, Turkey, and finally complacency in the region. I'll start with you, Tom, and then I think we'll begin to wrap up with the panel.
Right, well, that's a fine set of questions. I don't know if I'll be able to tackle them all. I think Turkey could be a useful player in the region, but isn't yet. I mean, it's certainly an economic player, which is good already. And I think Turkey's kind of small business economic boom over the last 10 years could be a very good model for the South Caucasus. Turkey used to be dominated by these oligarchic corporations, and I think the Caucasus is economies are stuck in where Turkey was 20, 30 years ago. But I think it would be what wouldn't be helpful is if Turkey tried to be a mediator in the Karabakh conflict. I think Armenia doesn't want Turkey in that role, and I think Turkey should respect that. I think, as in so often in this region, it's about timing. And I think what was unfortunate, from my perspective, was one, that this Turkey-Armenia process was a bit rushed. And second, that there was not more sequencing involved, in the sense that I think if the border had opened, Turkey-Armenia border had opened, this would actually have good impact on the Karabakh conflict, and stabilised the region. And I think it would have been good for Azerbaijan in the long run, I think it would have been a short-term symbolic defeat, as it were, quote-unquote, for Azerbaijan. So it was what should have been done, what should have been done better in that process was, I think, to factor in Azerbaijan and make the argument publicly and privately to Azerbaijan that this was a good process and that they should not feel excluded from it, unfortunately. The message sent to Azerbaijan is that we're kind of trying to do this around you, we're not inviting you to meetings, and they successfully became spoilers in the process. I think it's not completely over, but I think it could get back on track after next year's Turkish elections, but there has to be something given to Azerbaijan, which is not everything they want, but something. And I, actually, the point I get back to when timing on Georgia, which is again, I think, and unfortunately, I think policy towards Georgia kind of fed what was already a national trait in Georgians, which was as an impatience. President Saakashvili came to office in 2004 with an amazing mandate, probably the strongest mandate any post-Soviet leader has ever had. And he tried to do everything at once and was encouraged, I think, too much to try and do everything at once. If he'd concentrated on his state-building project, done some modest outreach to the Abkhaz and South Ossetians. Remember, the Russians at that point were a long way from recognising those two territories. South Ossetia, I think, could easily have fallen into Georgia's lap with a bit of strategic patience. I think if he postponed the NATO issue, saying we aspire to it, but as a long-term project, not as this is not something for our first term, then I think Georgia would be on a far better path than it is today. A couple of words on Karabakh. I think that's a very good question about narratives. The interesting thing is you go to both countries and there's actually a great deal of cynicism amongst the leaderships that they say, oh, but we can change the narrative. And at the moment we decide we're ready for a peace deal, we can change the narratives. We can just make a couple of phone calls to the head of the national TV and suddenly we'll all be friends again. It's obviously not so simple. I think they've released and encouraged nationalist forces. The leaders have encouraged nationalist forces in these countries which are stronger than they are. But I do think that it's up to outsiders to, as it were, choreograph a change of narrative and say, hang on a moment, you're just talking yourselves into a war which no one wants, and to choreograph a change of the narrative, which wouldn't happen overnight, actually, but it would be a downturning of the aggressive rhetoric. And then the leaders beginning to talk in a coordinated fashion so that the message, it wasn't sort of one side, not the other, talk about how we actually both have a peace agreement. Just a small comment on that as well. Baku says that it accepts the Madrid principles with reservations. And it turns out when you talk to them, the strongest, we have one reservation. What is that reservation? That reservation is about the status of Karabakh itself, which is, of course, the fundamental issue in the whole process. So when they say they accept it's the Madrid principles, we have to take that with a small grain of salt.
Three quick sentences. One reason we don't have a coherent strategy for the region is we don't have a coherent strategy over the same view as Turkey has. And we don't even really talk to Turkey, to be quite honest, at a strategic level about a common strategy. Second, the fundamental question, and the fundamental strategy has got to be, over time, how do you get Russians, encourage Russians to view their neighbors in these regions differently? I say that, we have tried to do that for 15 years with very little success, let's be honest. But fundamentally, this only changes if Russia moves beyond a zero-sum calculation and starts thinking differently. And in many ways, the Iranians were playing for time, trying to chip away at that big issue. And that's what reset is also all about in this region, to be quite honest. And the question is whether that's enough to keep the region stable while we hope that some of these other processes play themselves out. Last but not least, and this is part of the debate comment I have, in my book, I actually argue that it was long ago for a map at Bucharest, because I think we didn't mean it, and it provoked the Russians to think that the window was closing, when the window was never closing. The map wasn't NATO membership. Misha had never expected to get in this first term. We had different timelines, but it was a much longer term progress. But it was the prospect of Georgia moving in that direction which contributed to Russian strategy. And it probably would have been better in retrospect to do everything, but we ended up fighting over words. If we had been fighting over 10 programs to improve things on the ground in Georgia, we would have been much better off than a long map, which I helped design. It was never meant to do what people were asking it to do at Bucharest. It became a holy grail, completely blown out of proportion. We should have just done stuff on the ground that made a real difference, as opposed to investing all this political capital in a sentence. We communicate, because now we broke the consensus that we could have had in the alliance, and you have to rebuild it.
Well, with the external access work, you bring more coherence. That's why it's being created. What can we do to overcome complacency? Well, we can. We have to continue to pay attention. There's a lot of awareness raising to be done. I think this kind of event is very useful in terms of that. In terms of that awareness raising, we have to continue to develop the instruments that we now have. The war in Georgia came as a kind of wake-up call and re-energized, for example, the EU in not only to immediately deploy its monitoring mission in Georgia, but also energized the discussion on the Eastern Partnership and created the conditions for this new program to get off the ground, and we have to continue to pay attention to that and fill it with contents and to make sure that the countries in the region see it as useful, see the benefits, and it improves quite a lot in terms of a new kind of relationship with the EU involving freedom of movement, involving free trade, and so on, and also a regional dimension. We have to avoid the temptation of refreezing the conflicts, which is an illusion anyway. They cannot be it's impossible to freeze to freeze these conflicts, and we have to point out the dangers of trying to walk down that path. Now, a couple of words also on Turkey, because I think this is a very interesting question. Turkey has punched far below its weight in the South Caucasus, and the Turks realized, the Turkish government realized this, and saw an opportunity after the Georgia war. They launched a platform for security and stability. They launched in earnest the talks with Armenia on a normalization, all of which was intended to serve the strategic purpose of creating space for Turkey to be a fully fledged actor in the South Caucasus. At the same time, I think this may have come a little bit quickly. There were some inconsistencies in the Turkish approach. The fact that the platform for security and stability as external partners only involved Russia, Turkey and Russia caused some concern among the countries in the region and limited the impact of that initiative. And as far as Turkey, the Turkish-Armenian normalization is concerned, at the same time, Turkey tried, partly because of the external pressure it was under from Azerbaijan, but partly because of its own volition, tried also to insert itself indirectly as a player on the Karabakh conflict. In fact, as an additional external mediator on the Karabakh conflict, and that, which was also designed to serve the same strategic purpose of creating space for Turkey in the region. But that aspect of the Turkish policy now started to interfere with the Turkish-Armenian normalization effort and led to to the deadlock not a total collapse of the Turkish Armenian organization, but a deadlock that will probably take some time now to overcome. But this, I think, will provide us with a little bit of breathing space also, and perhaps have this dialogue with Turkey about objectives and strategic goals in the region. Turkey is, I would say, indispensable as a partner in the South Caucasus.
Thank you. I'd like to bring the debate to a close since we're already over time, but I'd like to thank, first of all, our excellent panellists for their thoughtful insights into the spectrum issue of the South Caucasus. If I take anything away, it's that we approach the issue in an atmosphere of greater partnership, and a feeling of the reset having replaced or with a will to replace the zero-sum game in the region, take away the idea of strategic insignificance not being such a bad thing after all. But I also take away the fact that Europe cares about this region deeply and sees a future for this region as a strong partner in its neighbourhood. So let's hope these debates can continue, and look forward to seeing you all at the next one. Thank you very much.